Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
All right, everyone, welcome to episode 10 of the Be The Right Club Today podcast. We're delighted to have professional golfer and caddy Sandy Armour join us today. Sandy, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I am doing great. And Hal, how are you doing?
I'm good, Jamie.
So Sandy's
been a good friend for a long time, and I'm happy to have you on here, Sandy.
Oh, thanks, Hal. You're a good friend, and I really enjoyed caddying for you, probably more than any of the others.
Well, you had to say that since we're on the podcast right now. But anyway, we go back a long ways. Your brother and I qualified for the tour the same place, the same year. So I've known you and your brother for a very long time. And, you know, having you on here today is fun because, I mean, I want you to tell people about your grandfather, first of all. Tell them who he is. They may not put the connection together, so help them.
My grandfather's name is Tommy Armour. The Silver Scot was his nickname from Scotland. He World War One veteran. A lot of people that have heard of him, or they didn't know that he played golf with one eye. He was blind in World War One. He won three majors. He won the PGA, the Open Championship, and the U.S. Open. And some tough courses. He won at Carnoustie, and he won at Oakmont. And he won like 27 other events. Canadian Open a couple of times. Running buddies with Babe Ruth and Walter Hagen and those gentlemen of that era. And hell of a golfer.
Yeah. Yes, he was. You and your brother, too.
Yeah, I didn't really get to know. Well, thank you. Thank you. Trying to catch up with you is what we were doing.
Well, so you were about to say you didn't really get to know him.
Well, my dad was a doctor in the Air Force.
Right.
And we were stationed in Madrid. Grandfather, he got sick in the late 60s. I was born in 1960. And so I was only around him a handful of times. He was on the West Coast. We were on the West Coast moving to Las Vegas from Spain. And he was in Boca in New York. And then he got sick and never saw him after that. He passed away in late 60s. But he taught my mom how to play and my dad. They were both fine golfers, you know, 2-3 handicaps, club champions. But grandma told me some bunch of stories about he and Babe Ruth liked to run together.
Yeah.
Golf and maybe have an adult beverage in the evening.
Oh, they wouldn't do that, would they? I see that smile.
probably more than one or two.
So you're in Birmingham.
So go ahead.
You're in Birmingham for the first major this year for the Champions Tour.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
So golf course is in good shape, you said, yep. And you're caddying for Michael Allen this week, and y'all are ready to win, right?
Well, let's start with play well. He's not feeling that well. He's got a chest cold.
Well, he's a good player. He's capable.
He's capable. He drives it well. He starts holes well. He drives it really good. Good iron player. Hits a lot of greens. And it's a 4 days of walking, which might be challenging for a guy with a chest cold. I think Michael's 63 now. But a great guy, and we'll have a fun walk for sure.
Jamie, you got some questions you want to ask Andy?
Yes, Andy. So you spent some time in the mini tours. What was that experience like for you?
It's mini tours, state opens. You know, it's tough. It's a tough way to make a living. Trying to make enough money to get your entry fee and for the next tournament. Not always on the best conditioned courses, but you develop some lifelong friends like John Daly and Tom Lehman, and you know, guys that didn't just jump onto the tour first try and stay there. It was it's tough traveling by car, getting out of your car, and you know, some guys had to sleep in their cars, not play well for a couple of weeks, and don't have a big sponsor. You're eating rice and beans.
what was traveling like with John Daly?
About like you would imagine. He was a great guy. He really is. He doesn't treat himself actually the best, but he does a lot of charity work. There's, I don't know if you remember that, like at Hazeltine, I think it was, lightning hit a tree and it killed a man that was like mid to late 30s and had two or three kids. John never met the guy, and he formed a charity golf tournament for a couple of years to put those kids through school.
Yeah.
Talk about yours and Tommy's relationship.
Oh, that, you know, it's just the two of us, and we've always been close. We were on the same little league team. I was a pitcher and he was a catcher, and you know, we grew up in Las Vegas and on the desert, in which was a good golf course. They used to have the Tournament of Champions there before it went to La Costa. And, we could walk out the back gate and play golf after school or baseball or football. We were always very close. And then when you two got your tour cards, I wanted to play too. So I asked Tommy, I said, I'd like to come caddy for you and see what's going on, see how these guys play and what I need to work on. And that's 1982. I went out, first tournament I caddy for Tommy was in Memphis at Colonial. And that's when I really met the famous Freddie Burns. And he and I have been dear friends, and we're still traveling together today. We share a room almost every week, and it's just life in the golf world has been very nice to Sandy Armour. I got to say that.
Well, it's been very good to a lot of us, and the three of us on this podcast has been very good to us, and that's why we continue to do things. That's why Jamie and I do this podcast, is so that people can meet personalities like you and know a little bit about your life and what you do. And, we've had ups and downs. Every golfer in the world has had ups and downs, and everybody on this podcast right now, we've all had both of those. And, I hope this week is one of those ups for you and Michael. And old Freddie, I miss him. He and I spent many, many years together. And he was on the podcast one other time before, and everybody loved it when he was on. And, I like doing things like this with you and Freddie, because y'all have an insight that most people don't have the opportunity to have. You got a bird's eye view of what's going on with some of the best players in the world. And share some of those stories with everybody, things that stand out in your memory.
No, it's by far the best seat in the house. And seeing golfers, in the best golfers in the world, in the under pressure and how they handle it. And it's some of the greatest rounds I've seen. I caddied for Olin Brown for 7 years before he sold me to Darren Clark. And I think it was for a bottle of red or maybe a burrito. I'm not sure. But watch caddying for Olin Brown at Carnoustie and watching him shoot 66 was in the senior open championship. Every shot he hit was a high quality shot. Every putt looked like it had a chance to go in on an extremely difficult golf course. That round, as far as me caddying for somebody, was one of them for sure. And happened to be where my grandfather won the Open Championship. Caddying for my brother on the regular tour for 17 years or whatever it was, had some really good rounds. One, he finished third at Congressional. Anthony Kim shot 65 or something on Sunday and won the tournament. But my grandfather was a pro at Congressional, so it had some meaning there. And Tommy played exceptionally well. I think he only missed like fairways all week, hit numerous greens, and that was a lot of fun too. I mean, then watching some great players a couple of weeks ago in Palm Springs, I'm caddying for Matt Gogel, and we play with Retief Goosen on Sunday, and he was 9 under after 12 holes. And you just watching somebody like that not miss a shot on a good golf course, it's you get an idea how good these guys really are. And sometimes, you know, you run into somebody and says, hey, you know, I've been in business my whole life and I'm 48 and I think I'm gonna give the Champions Tour a try. And you know, it's these guys are still really, really good. It's just maybe challenged by length a little bit, but other than that, when they come down the stretch, you know, the chance to win, they rarely ever make bogeys. They make pars and birdies, and it's a treat. I spent yesterday afternoon with Michael Chipping, and Ernie Els came by with his son playing a late practice round, and it's a really cool place to be when you're over 50 and playing, being friends with Hall of Famers, and they're regular people, and you know, they're just really, really good and love what they do, and I've been blessed for sure.
For you, Sandy, who was your kind of first full-time player you had, you were caddying for? When did you first start doing that?
I caddied for my brother, Tommy Armour III.
Yeah.
He's 15 months older, and I caddied for him for half the year in 1982, and then I went on and played myself and played all over the world and 20 different countries, Australia, South Africa, Asia, Europe, all over, almost every state in the U.S. And then I had a teaching center with Hank Haney.
Yeah.
For about 5 years in Southern California. And that was a blast.
Yeah.
I had a number of young Korean kids, and they all were in high school. And they all got scholarships at major golf universities. And that was very gratifying. And their parents, you know, continue to thank me, you know, because, you know, not only did the kid feel a great accomplishment and self-confidence, but it, you know, saved the parents a couple $100,000, I would think. So they're grateful. And then I caddy in full time for Tommy on the regular tour, and we packed up a car, and he and Hal flew a lot. And Freddie and I would drive a lot, and they just met so many nice people, like Nick Price and Ben Crenshaw. These are quality individuals.
Yeah.
And not having a 9-to-5 job, being out on the best golf courses with the best golfers, and when you play well, you get paid nice money, not like today. Today's money is just amazing. These guys are fortunate, and I think some of them should express that more often than, that's, golf has exploded, and we'll see how they handle it.
Yeah, it's changed a lot over the years, the money that's getting given out. Hal's got a check in here from when he won the PGA in 83. And it's not quite as much as what they get now.
Like
when
Riviera.
That's right. It's a little bit less than what they get now. So when you were working, I know I've listened to a couple of podcasts you've done in the past, like when you were working with Darren, and you've obviously worked as a coach. So how much time do you spend with your players you're caddying for now? Do you talk to them much about their own golf swing still?
Oh yeah. Michael and I were working on the chipping yesterday.
Yeah.
And Darren is probably one of the top 10 talented golfers tee to green that I've ever watched or witnessed, let alone caddy for 2 years. We won, three tournaments and finished third at Sunningdale, finished third at the Schwab Cup. Delightful guy. He's got that Cheshire cat grin. And the accent doesn't help. It doesn't hurt. It's just, again, to have met some of these guys and be able to work with them and make a living. And then the teaching part with Darren was, he asked me to caddy for him because of being able to help him and tell him what his swing was doing. And he was, when I started, he was using the launch monitor. And he's trying to hit it as far as he could with as much carry, and his swing path was a bit into out and up, like a lot of the teachers teach, to hit it maximum distance. But his irons suffered because that swing path was not the most accurate for irons. And right away, we won the second tournament, getting the swing a little bit more on plane, more. I watched the 2011 Open Championship that he won at Royal St. George, and I noticed that he was always very similar to Hal. He was on top of the ball, he covered it, he flighted the ball. I called it links golf. I said, Darren, you're a links guy. You're not a high flying ball guy. You're not a Nicklaus or a Tiger. You drive the ball well. And the second tournament we won. And he hadn't won a tournament since Royal St. George 10 years earlier. And then we won the next tournament in Hualalai at the Tournament of Champions in a windy condition on Hawaii. And that was gratifying. Not just the money that I made, but, helping somebody get back on top. And it's great. I learned a lot from Jose Olazabal. A prince of a guy he is. He's helped me about 5 years ago in Newport Beach. I asked him, I said, Jose, can I, you tell me how you chip? Because every time you chip, it either hits the cup or it stops, a foot or two. It's like you're the master. And he said, okay, I'll show you what I do and I'll help you. But you cannot tell Olin Brown, because I was caddying for Olin at the time. And just his humor, and it was And I was sharing some of that with Michael yesterday, with Michael Allen.
Yeah.
And he's like, wow, he was, you know, I used to roll the face open and then try and hold it to keep the bounce. And he said, you're telling me and you're showing me videos of Jose, who everybody knows is the master, and he and Seve at short game, and his face is shut. He goes from closed to open.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, well, he told me that he likes the club adding loft and adding bounce. So with the face is somewhat people think is closed, going to open, that happens. If you open the face right away and then you start closing it, now you're taking loft off the club and you're taking bounce off the club and you're exposing the leading edge to the ground and the rough, and especially Bermuda rough. If you're into the grain and you're not using the bounce, you can see some embarrassing shots from high quality players. So the teaching part is, it's I'm able to coach some guys and help them, and that's rewarding too.
Yeah. From Ola Thabo, now he obviously spent a lot of time with Seve. Did him and Seve have the same chipping technique, or were they slightly different?
No, very different. Extremely different. Seve liked his wedges to be shaped with almost onset. Okay. For anybody listening, that means that the leading edge is almost on the left edge of the shaft as you're looking down. Jose likes a double bend, where so now the leading edge is near the back of the shaft. And Seve would roll, he would open the face at address with different clubs and close the face. Jose stands very square to the target with the ball in the middle and the face almost always square to the target. He never lays it open on its back or whatever. And they really were very different and both extremely, you know, effective in their different styles. And, you know, it's Jose, like I said, has taught me a lot about chipping because he uses the same technique in the sand. Square stance, ball in the middle, square face. And it's a very simple process, and therefore it's a lot easier to repeat.
Yeah.
Doesn't require a ton of practice if you're laying the face open. Well, now you got to, you know, where are your hands? Are you leaning the shaft too much forward or back? And then are you opening up your body too much? To where you're getting a glancing blow, hitting a lot of chip shots off the toe of the club, or the hosel is exposed, or... Jose's is very, very simple. And again, fortunate to have gotten to know him and him share what he does, what got him in the Hall of Fame, because it wasn't his driver.
Now, you mentioned that Darren Clark was one of the best players tee to green that you'd seen. What about his technique or his mindset made him that?
Learning to hit the ball in tough, windy conditions. I'm sorry, I was just watching Vijay Singh hit it, go for the green here on 18 in the Pro-Am. Growing up in Northern Ireland on those courses with that weather condition, you either learn to hit the ball solid repeatedly and control the flight, or you quit playing golf and get a job. And so striking, if you study guys in the Hall of Fame, that's what I like to do. You can tell that there's certain things that are not absolute fundamentals, because there's like Jose, his grip is considered maybe 20, let's call it 20 degrees weak. And then there's other guys that are 30 degrees strong. So that's not a, having a perfect grip is not part of the equation to get in the Hall of Fame. Aiming left, Fred Couples Trevino, some of those guys aim quite a bit left, and Kenny Perry. Kenny Perry aims 30 yards left of the target, but he hits a high hook. Yeah, if you tried to teach that to somebody, you know, they might suggest you get a psychiatrist. It's studying what they do is they all strike the ball and then the ground repeatedly. And they found something that they can repeat under pressure and it'll hold up. The other players you've seen in the past, like guys like Martin Keimer, just comes to mind. Major champion. I'm going to change my swing. I want to do something different. I want to maybe try and hit high draws for Augusta. And then, well, you haven't seen much of Martin Keimer after that. Some guys, like Kenny Perry, his fade actually draws about 2 or 3 yards. His normal shot draws about 10 to 15.
Yeah.
But he knows he can repeat that. Even if there's water right or what the wind's doing, they hit the ball solid repeatedly, and they repeat. And I talked with Hal, I caddied for him for about a year on this Champions Tour. And there's some guys have like a speed limit. If they try and hit a ball too hard, their swing gets quick, and the face isn't where they think it's going to be of an impact.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask Nick Price to slow his swing down, or Tom Watson, you probably have never heard from him.
Yeah.
If you ask Fred Couples to speed up his swing, or Vijay Singh, you probably would have never heard of them either. Mm-hmm. So it's a personality thing, and you know what fits your, what you're comfortable and what you're able to repeat. And Butch Harmon is the coach he is because none of his students have the same looking swing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's he's worked with Dustin Johnson and Fred Couples and Phil Mickelson and Tiger, and he's able to get to them, you know, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, and how to avoid having to play with your weaknesses. Just stay with your strengths and, you know, be confident. Because a couple of bad shots and your confidence bag gets a hole in it.
Yeah.
And then golf can get really, really, really difficult. How was your game?
Not that great. I was mostly a club pro the last 10 or so years. I tried a little bit of mini tour stuff, but you find out pretty quickly when you go to mini tours whether you should get a real job or not.
Right.
And I got a rude awakening. I've been in Houston here now 10 years. I miss Scotland a little bit. I miss the golf over there. I miss Lynx golf.
Right. The other thing is a lot of these teachers today, they're so wrapped up in the launch monitor. And yeah, velocity is, speed is really important if you want to play on the PGA Tour, because all those kids are in good shape and they hit it a mile. And to compete, you can't play from 40 yards behind them.
No.
Because they're hitting wedges. When you're hitting 7 irons, you might get them a hole here and there, but over the course of 4 days, they're going to hit it closer to the hole, and then they're going to make a couple more putts. And
yeah,
that's it. But the laws of, like, Hal hit the flag 4 times at the Pebble Beach tournament in one tournament. And I believe Freddie told me he ripped the flag out of the hole with a one iron. And having seen Hal hit thousands and thousands of shots, you know, I know that to be true.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and anybody that's listening to Hal Sutton about how to hit a golf ball, they're in good hands.
Yeah. It was funny. I was in the academy here a couple of weeks ago, and or maybe a month ago now, and Hal doesn't really play too much anymore. You know, he's got his injuries and whatnot, but he was teaching in the academy, and then his student left, and we were indoors. So all of a sudden, I hear this like thud, thud. I'm like, someone's hitting balls in here, but there's no one else in here apart from Hal. And I poke my head around the corner, and Hal's hitting some seven irons. He's got this like seven iron blade that I wouldn't dream of hitting. And he hadn't played that. He hadn't played that much, and he was striking it so good. And every shot was just, now he was hitting like a 5 yard pull. And to him, he was disgusted. He was like, I just can't get it straight. But every shot he hit was just like the same trajectory and had like hardly any curve and just a slight pull. And right. I'm just watching this like, man, that's unbelievable. For a guy that doesn't really play much anymore, he picked out that seven iron and just started striping one after the other. And I was like, yeah. Yeah, he's pretty good.
Yeah. It's, for some of them, it's like riding a bike. Others, yeah. Not so much.
Hal's, yeah. Yeah. It was impressive to watch. But, you know, back to your distance comment there, I heard a story from you in a podcast in the past about, I think it was when Darren won an event and you met Montgomery outside the Colin Montgomery outside a hotel or something like that. And Montgomery was commenting how he was going to find it hard to beat Darren just because of the distance, right?
Yeah, that was in Hawaii at Hualalai. It's a tournament of champions. We played a practice round with Paul Broadhurst and Colin.
Yeah.
And Darren was firing on all cylinders, and he's hitting it, you know, 40, 50 yards past Colin and Broadhurst and in the middle of the fairway. And a lot of irons. I mean, he'd hit the iron and the flag would be ducking. And after the round, Darren went back to his room, and I was standing outside the clubhouse waiting for the shuttle. And Colin was there, and he goes, I don't know how I could beat him, let alone, you know, he's hitting wedges and I'm hitting sevens and six irons. And he's hitting his wedges close too, and he's putting well, and he's short, he's chipping it, you know, when he does miss a shot. And that length it's a huge advantage, and it's kind of, you know, I agree with a lot of some of these people that some of the courses are becoming obsolete, and they're great courses.
Yeah.
I know, you know, like Pebble Beach is only, I don't think it's officially over 7,000 yards,
mm-hmm.
but they got small greens. And if there's some wind blowing there, it's a very difficult golf course. But if it's calm, as Tiger showed years ago, if it's calm there, 65 is par for him.
Yeah.
And that's because he's driving it, you know, 300 plus in cold, heavy air. So you're hitting wedges, you know, you're hitting wedges at 10 flags and you're damn good with a wedge. You're going to shoot in the mid 60s.
Yeah. Who's the longest out in the Champions Tour right now? Harrington's got to be up there, right?
Harrington, Ernie Els. Retief Goosen still hits a very long. Vijay Singh, you know, if you're built like Vijay and Ernie, you're going to hit it long for many years.
Yeah.
They're big boys. They look like they could be a tight end or played tight end in the NFL. They're,
you know,
6'4", 6'5", and they're easy. I mean, Ernie swings so smooth, but he's got such a big arc.
Yeah.
He hits a ball and the ball just takes off. And Brant Jobe, who's injured, he hits it a long ways.
Yeah.
Let's see. Darren's right there with those boys. Maybe a step behind Ernie and Retief.
Yeah.
But then you look at David Toms, who's, you know, he's won a couple of times, and I hope he's okay. They took him to the hospital this morning in an ambulance. Oh. David Toms, he was not feeling good, and he was quite pale. And, you know, I told Hal before the show, I sure hope he's okay, because he's a really wonderful guy from Louisiana, also, you know, from Hal's state.
Yeah.
But he doesn't hit it that far.
Yeah.
But I call him very tidy, because he hits a lot of fairways, hits a lot of greens, chips well, and putts well.
Yeah.
And he doesn't make many mistakes. And still has, you know, like these guys, Ernie Els, I'm sure he's got a pretty good sized bank account. flies private wherever he goes. But last night he's out playing a late practice round at, you know, 6 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah.
They just love to compete and get better and learn more about the course they're playing this week. And it's, these guys are still have a burning passion. Jose is playing very poor golf from what he says, and his scores don't show it, but he's on the range in the morning, goes out and plays, and he's on the range in the afternoon working on it. And he's in the hall. they get that bug and don't lose it for a long time. It's just fun to be a part of this for sure.
Yeah, Hal and I talk a little bit about that with like the likes of Bernard Langer and whatnot. It's amazing how that desire to improve is with like guys like that their whole life.
How about Stephen Auker?
Yeah,
I mean, he's speaking of mini tours and state opens, and he persisted. And he gets, turns 50 and comes out here, and he's, you know, he's done some amazing things, and what a nice guy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm happy for him. He lost his caddy in January. A dear friend of mine, Sam, passed away, and, you know, Sam was on the Corn Ferry Tour with him as well for, you know, a handful of years, and that's tough living. Grinding it out, practicing them, and then finally get to the big show and the senior tour and start winning tournaments, finishing top 10 almost every week, top 5, third, second, first. And you know, he's out here before the pro-am this morning hitting balls, and he'll probably hit some afterwards. It requires to be on top, you know, to beat these guys.
Yeah.
You get better stay sharp.
Yeah, I mean you've seen it. I've seen it a little bit, but like when you're grinding mini tours, even Corn Ferry Tour, a lot of people out there maybe listening, it's a grind. You gotta really want it if you're gonna hang around there for a long time.
Yeah, well, there's guys that work smart, and there's guys that work hard.
Yeah.
And there's a big difference. I mean, granted, you need to hit it long, but you can hit it. Let me say this: you'd rather be long and wild, than short and wild. You can't play. You can't be short and wild and play professional golf.
No, but
you can be long and wild. And then 70% of most shots happen within 120 yards of the hole. So if you're spending 70% of your time on the range hitting drivers and so on, your short game is probably going to suffer, and you'll probably end up staying right where you are.
Yeah.
Bernhard Langer, people ask me, you know, I've been around the course with him many times in tournaments, and he misses the ball so well. When these guys are playing really well, when they miss hit a shot and still have a birdie putt, they're really tough to beat. It's amazing. You know, sometimes Bernhard may not hit the best sounding shot.
Yeah.
And you look up and it's still going, oh, you know, this one's 5 yards left of the flag and it has, you know, pretty good distance too. <He's> like, that was his bad shot. No wonder he's won 45 of these tournaments on this tour alone.
I think that's great and advice.
Auker is doing the same thing.
Yeah.
He drives it. He's got good length. He has good flight on the ball. He's got birdie putts with his miss hit shots.
Yeah.
And if you can get to that point, then you can think about playing against these guys.
Yeah, you're going to have a chance. My miss hit was a 20-yard pull hook with a 7-iron, so I didn't have much chance. But I think that's great advice for listeners to the pod. You know, a lot of people tune in are looking for advice in their own game and practicing. If they can spend more time practicing their short game, get the wedges and the putter in their hands and put themselves around the green and practicing getting up and down, I think that's way more beneficial than standing a range and belting 7-iron after 7-iron after 7-iron.
True. There's some things that, even with all the technology, haven't changed. Now, to hit a golf ball straight, you need to have straight backspin.
Mm-hmm.
And if you create your swing to do that, you got a better chance of keeping it out of the trees and the ponds and the bunkers. And you know, if you find if people listening that need you know, a slice, you know, a lot of golf is opposite.
Yeah.
If your ball is going right, they swing more left, and that puts more slice spin on the ball.
Yeah.
You need to swing more right if the ball's going too far right to counter the spin.
Yeah.
And you know, they look at themselves, well, I lifted my head. Well, you know, probably not. You hit the ball.
Yeah.
You know, if you're missing the ball completely, then you might consider that you're lifting your head.
Yeah.
Or your clubs are too short.
Well, Sandy, I really appreciate you joining us today. I think Hal had some technical difficulties there, so he dropped out there. But it was a pleasure to meet you and chat with you. And I'd love to get you back on maybe later in the year for you and Hal to reminisce about some old stories. But thanks again, Sandy, and good luck this week.
Thank you so much. And I enjoyed chatting with you. And anytime you want to continue, Hal's got my number, and you can get it from him or when he gets a decent phone or whatever he was on.
We'll see.
But I love Hal.
Thank
you much for a wonderful chat.
All right. Well, thanks, Sandy. Best luck this week, and good luck the rest of the year, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks now.
All right. Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
See ya.